This, the 20th year in the life of the United Nations, is being observed throughout the world as International Cooperation Year, in the belief that greater awareness of the achievements of cooperation, rather than a preoccupation with conflict, will advance the cause of peace and human welfare. To contribute to this objective, United Nations Radio is presenting a series of special programs on the extent and nature of cooperation through international organizations. In this program, the speaker is Alexander Scorby.
I'm one of those people whose talent for big business and high finance is woefully underdeveloped. Nervously fingering the small change in my pocket, I stand in awe of those who calmly deal in millions, whether they be corporation magnates or government planners. Still, I can recognize good business when I see it. To spend $17 million, for example, and get $780 million in return sounds like a useful transaction by any standard. And I didn't just pull those figures out of thin air. They're the result of combined operations by the UN and 16 different governments in the current struggle for economic development in the poorer parts of the world. And I want to come back to them in a moment. First, though, let's look at those words, combined operations. During the last 20 years or so, something has been happening to economic thinking and policy throughout the world. An idea has been taking shape which would have been considered quite unfeasible in the rather haphazard past. It's the idea that a rational and deliberate design for influencing economic forces so as to change their spontaneous course of evolution and attain clear objectives is not only possible, but essential. That, by the way, was a quote from a report to last year's big UN conference on trade and development, prepared by the distinguished Argentinian economist who was its Secretary General, Raúl Prebisch. The same idea was expressed by the president of the conference, Dr. A. M. Kaisuni of the United Arab Republic, in his opening address. What is now at stake, he said, is not the particular economic interests of a few countries. Rather,
it is the pattern, the trends, and the shortcomings of trade that exists between all of us. It is the vast possibilities for development that could be opened to humanity through a more rational utilization of its resources and a better international economic order. It is the common interest and goals that we must not fail to promote collectively, whatever may be our differences, as otherwise, in the final analysis, we shall all be the losers.
To say that most people are beginning to recognize the truth of this is not, of course, to say that we've entered the era of universal affluence, or even that we're now marching bravely towards it hand in hand. As one delegate to the conference put it, you can't force cooperation in a field like trade, and you certainly can't. In the highly variable blender called international relations, economic and political interests often emerge as identical twins. And let's be honest, that venerable specter called power can still wag a beckoning finger. Nevertheless, the trend towards new forms of international economic integration is clearly visible, if you don't spend all your time examining the opportunities for disintegration. The regional concepts of common markets, for example, in Europe, Latin America, Asia, and Africa. The European community is understandably the furthest advanced, but it has had to negotiate some very tricky corners along the way. This cooperative trend has been welcomed by most economists, providing, they always add, that it doesn't produce a number of exclusive, inward-looking clubs with the global obligation to eradicate mass poverty running a poor second in their scales of value. So, along with this trend towards regional cooperation, and in a few cases it is more than just a trend, you have the pressure to do something about the poverty problem on a world basis. The UN Conference on Trade and Development was a product of this pressure. Politeness was not always its chief characteristic, but that's neither here nor there. The important point is that in examining the complexities of international trade and its links to economic growth, 120 nations received a fine education in understanding, without which, of course, it's pretty difficult to cooperate. And what's more, the conference is to continue its work as a permanent organ of the UN General Assembly. A new machine has been built in which the gears of negotiation can be continuously engaged to harmonize, in the words of the UN Charter, the actions of nations in the attainment of common ends. Now, at this stage, I'd like to flip the development coin and bring up trade's partner in the process, aid. And I'd like to recall those rather startling figures I mentioned at the beginning. I heard them quoted in a speech given a few weeks ago at a meeting at UN headquarters. Here's the relevant bit.
Our most recent figures on investment follow-up show that 17 fund-assisted surveys, of which only 12 are completed, have already attracted development capital from public and private sources totaling $785 million. Since the cost of these surveys, including the funds provided by the recipient countries, was some $17 million, the return is on the order of 46 to 1.
Paul Hoffman, Managing Director of the UN Special Fund, an instrument for international cooperation dedicated to the conviction that, as this planet of ours is naturally a very rich one, there are no insurmountable technical obstacles to prevent us from converting potential wealth into wealth in being. So the fund supplies funds which are matched and generally exceeded by contributions from recipient governments for what is broadly called pre-investment work, surveys of natural resources like minerals, or feasibility studies on the establishment of industries, or training institutions for badly needed technicians and administrators. There's really no need to elaborate on the scope of the fund's activities, except perhaps to say that the various specialized agencies in the UN family take part as the executors of the various projects. The point I would rather make is that it's in such activities by the special fund, or in the equally various technical cooperation activities of the UN and its agencies, that you discover an entirely new phenomenon in the world economy, or at least a phenomenon that was virtually unknown 20 years ago. Back in January, this was referred to in a lecture on international cooperation given by a former president of Colombia and a distinguished writer, Dr. Alberto Camargo. Here's how he put it.
No son los jefes de gobierno o sus inmediatos colaboradores los únicos que hoy pueden hablar sobre los...
It is not only the heads of government or their immediate collaborators who can today speak of the problems of their countries, but an army of technicians have woven a network of complicated international communications beneath the foreign offices. It's a world composed of modest workers, technicians, men of goodwill, men and women in sweaters with no diplomatic uniforms, by a vast middle class that will prove its unity to the world, show its ability as a growing human race, attest to its modernity, sense of justice, and organization. This is the great humanist revolution to which nothing human is alien.
This is also, I might add, where you encounter the deep grassroots of international cooperation, where you meet the sweated hundreds and thousands now sharing their skills with those who need them. I'd like you to hear one of them for a moment. Why I selected him from so many, I don't really know. Maybe his name caught my eye. It's Neil Worker. He's from New Zealand, a country that knows a lot about raising cattle and sheep. He's at work for FAO on a special fund project in Argentina, another country that produces some very tender steaks. But the Argentinians would like to do even more, for the export of beef is a major source of income for them. Anyhow, in this project, Neil Worker's main interest and skill is in improving the reproductive rate in cattle. And he recorded a tape for me in a laboratory at the Argentine National Institute of Agricultural Technology near Buenos Aires.
In this line, we have achieved a considerable amount. We are setting up an animal production, an animal demonstration unit on 240 hectares on the demonstration farm, aimed at introducing improved strains of pastures and forages and improved animal management techniques, all aimed at demonstrating improved methods of increasing animal productivity per hectare.
Through agricultural extension services, the findings at the Institute are being applied to more than 20 million sheep and cattle throughout the country already. And what happens when Neil Werker and the other internationally recruited experts leave Argentina in a year or so.
There is no question that we will leave behind us, in the first place, for example, a number of very well-trained and very highly trained technicians. And as well, we will leave behind us a fully equipped and functional animal demonstration unit in which we hope will be incorporated all the latest findings and techniques from various overseas countries which in those particular countries are proving so successful in maintaining and increasing animal productivity.
I don't know about you, but that strikes me as a nice, clear picture of international cooperation at work for economic development. And it can work, too, even when the atmosphere is charged with conflict. For instance, if you were looking for the most tranquil spot on Earth today, you certainly wouldn't select Southeast Asia. And yet, for 8 years, that region has provided the world with one of its most remarkable examples of cooperation. 8 years ago, the UN's Economic Commission for Asia and the Far East invited representatives from Cambodia, Laos, South Vietnam, and Thailand to a meeting at its headquarters in Bangkok. The object? To see if these four countries could work together, with international assistance, to put the great untamed Mekong River to work for the benefit of the 20 million people who live in its lower basin, to generate power for them, to irrigate their land, and to carry their produce to markets. Here's proof that they have. Buddhist priests chanting. Not in a temple, but at a riverbank ceremony in Thailand. A ceremony at which the foundation stone of a dam at Sakolnakorn was laid last November. This is the Nam Pung Dam, one of five now under construction on tributaries of the Mekong. Others for the mainstream are now in the active planning stage. In other words, a dream is becoming a reality, and a long list of countries have helped in the transformation. I haven't time to list them, but here are a few. Canadians mapped the river from the air. Indians drew the plans for a dam. Americans made hydrology studies. Australians made geological surveys. Frenchmen investigated soils and fish life, and so on. 43 international teams are still operating in the basin on essential data collection. And during all this work, the coordinating point has been the four-country group that first met in 1957, the Mekong Development Committee. Their executive agent is a member of the UN Economic Commission in Bangkok, Dr. C. Hart Scharf. Talking about the project recently, he admitted that the conflicts in the area had had their effect on the work, but he also pointed out that the project was a big factor working against unrest. Here's one of his examples.
If you go back a year ago, two of these countries broke off relations, and one of the causes of their animosity was a proposed bridge and what the specifications of that bridge should be. Now, within the Mekong Committee, we've settled that issue. We've worked out agreed international specifications so that what once was on the verge of coming into the headlines as another big unrest factor has been quietly removed within the Mekong Committee by friendly discussion and wise technical advice, and that has prevailed.
There are lots of other stories like that in the UN files. The establishment, for example, of the African Development Bank, with its office at Abidjan, the capital of the Ivory Coast. With an authorized capital of $250 million and 31 participating governments, the significance of this new institution for Africa's economic future is obvious. And I'd like to go on about it, but I'm afraid I'm the victim of the tyranny of time. The other stories will have to wait for other programs. Many thanks for listening.
You've just heard Alexander Scorby in one of a series of special programs from UN Radio produced for 1965, International Cooperation Year.